G'day, and welcome to Follow the Money, the Australia Institute's podcast demystifying the big economic issues in Australia and putting them in plain English. Today, we're bringing you another guest from our Economics of a Pandemic webinar series. Adam Bandt, leader of the Australian Greens and member for Melbourne, is talking with our chief economist, Richard Dennis, about how to renew Australia with a Green New Deal. This was recorded live on Wednesday, the 27th of May 2020, and things may have changed since recording.
A national coalition of farming and environment groups wants Australia's economic recovery from the pandemic tinged green.
Technologies that can be used in our thermal generators and coal and gas generators are very, very important. So that is acknowledged in the report in a number of places. But again, the point here is balance.
I'm concerned that the gas-led recovery means that vast areas of prime farming country will be impacted by gas extraction.
Why have we chosen an industry that employs less than 0.2% of the workforce?
Coal is still the best option for Australia.
What I see is a big opportunity for Australia. It's in that area of energy, renewable energy.
Or the hydrogen.
The market's already spoken in terms of renewables. I mean, they've become competitive despite a decade of highly prohibitive government policy.
Put a lot of money into research of carbon capture and storage. Do you think it is really still worth pursuing?
We've had a decade of the climate wars. And the cost of that decade, that lost decade, is paid by Australians every time they switch on their lights.
The PM talks about economic sovereignty in the wake of this crisis. We're awaiting the government's electric car strategy. Is that a potential way, not just in terms of manufacturing?
So to unpack the details of a Green New Deal and how it would work, I'm delighted today to introduce the Greens leader, Adam Bandt, and our chief economist, Richard Dennis. Thanks, Adam. Thanks, Richard, for joining us.
Thanks. Thanks, Ebony. Great to be here.
First to you, I just wanted to start out, we'll get back to, I think, to the Prime Minister's press club speech a little bit later, but first, the Greens' economic recovery plan, what are some of the big issues and problems that you see that you're trying to address with that plan?
Yeah, thanks, Ebony, and I want to acknowledge that I'm coming here from Wurundjeri country in Melbourne. We've got a number of crises that are all crashing in together at once in this country, and we need a plan to not only get out of the current coronavirus-driven recession, if not depression, but to tackle those other crises as well. And that's basically the underpinning behind our plan. We've got the climate crisis, and I think it's worth remembering that although that's been bumped off the front page, it is reaching crisis point as we speak. There, you know, scientists are worried that down in Antarctica, there's a part of a little bit of one of the glaciers that holds on some of the other glaciers that acts like a little lock, and they're worried that it's melting now at rates that they thought it might melt out at in 10 or 20 years' time. And they're warning that if that little lock breaks off and bits of the ice sheet melts or breaks off and melts, then we could be locking in 3 to 4 metre sea level rises during the course of my daughter's lifetime, during the lifetime of today's primary school kids, which is really something quite catastrophic and terrifying. So I think as we have this discussion about economic recovery, sort of that little light needs to be blinking away in the corner of the screen to say that the climate crisis is still there and needs to be tackled. But we've also got, I think, what I would call a jobs and inequality crisis in Australia that existed before the coronavirus-induced recession, but with the dial of which has been really turned up by the corona crisis and the response. And I think it's probably best crystallised by thinking about the position of young people. There's lots of ways that this crisis is playing out. But before the crisis started, nearly 1 in 3 young people in this country, about 30% of young people, either had no job or didn't have enough hours of work. And that number of not only unemployment but underemployment, i.e. someone who's got a job but when you ask them, have you got enough hours of work, they say, no, I'm having trouble making ends meet. Underemployment for young people since the GFC really has remained persistently high. And in the first figures that we've seen from the corona crisis, that figure has jumped immediately. It's now about 4 in 10 young people either doesn't have a job or doesn't have enough hours of work, plus a whole bunch of young people have just completely left the labour force altogether over the last few weeks. And when you think about the industries where it's hit, hospitality, retail, tourism, that kind of makes a lot of intuitive sense. But what the history of previous recessions tells us is that the damage for young people can last for years, if not decades, if not a lifetime. And so we've got this big inequality crisis that's really hurting coming generations. We've got the climate crisis. We've got a jobs crisis. And what we're arguing with our plan, Invest to Recover, is that what we need to do is have a break from neoliberalism and basically say that the answer to all of these crises involves government getting its hands back on the steering wheel, government taking advantage of these historically low borrowing rates and investing in what we're calling nation-building and planet-saving projects to provide some hope and jobs and work and education and training for young people. But also we can't wait for the private sector to pick itself up. We can't wait for corporations to come and ride to the rescue. It's going to have to be government that accelerates out of this corner. Cuts won't be the answer. Shunting it off to other people to ask them in sort of Morrison's latest phone a friend response and say, oh, can someone else come up with the plan, won't be the answer. It's got to be government that gets its hands on the steering wheel and helps steer us out of this crisis.
Richard, you've been quite a critic of neoliberalism yourself. Does that sound like, you know, we're starting from trying to solve the right problems there?
Look, absolutely. And, you know, really so much that's going on at the moment can be made to seem sort of too much to fix or too complicated, or we can have a fight about what order to do things in. But actually, I think what Adam's just spelled out is really important, not just from an economic point of view, but from a democratic and parliamentary point of view. And that is that it's actually often easier to solve a couple of problems at the same time than it is to have bureaucratic fights about who's responsible for solving which bit or which bit should we solve first. So, you know, to take a household example, imagine you had an unemployed daughter who was a trained electrician and for whatever reason didn't have enough work at the moment, and you thought your electricity bill was really high and you know, you wish you could do something about that, and then a hailstorm comes along and smashes your roof. Looks like you've got three problems there, and you do. Which one should you fix first? Well, what if you try to fix all of them together? Maybe you don't just get the roof fixed, but while you're getting the roof fixed, you get the solar panels installed, and why not actually get your daughter to help with the work of doing that to save yourself a bit more money? So when we look at all the problems we need to solve, we can be bureaucratic and chop them up into little bits and say, well, you know, this is one minister's job and this is another minister's job, or this is the federal government's job and this is the state government's job. But real leadership and real problem solving actually often requires thinking, well, what are all the problems we face and how many of them can we solve at the same time? And that way we can actually unite people around solving multiple problems rather than divide people by saying, what's more important, your electricity bill or climate change? So I think, you know, there's lots of interesting stuff in the Greens' plan in terms of individual things we can do. But I also think what's really important is it's encouraging us to have a debate about how can we solve a few problems at the same time rather than get divided off and end up either only solving some of them or potentially not solving any of them.
So, Adam, for those who perhaps aren't familiar with it, do you want to take us through what are some of the big picture elements of your economic recovery plan?
Yeah, this our plan is called Invest to Recover, and you can find it just by Googling Greens Recovery Plan. But it's part of our Green New Deal approach to tackling the various crises that we're facing. And that takes its, obviously, its name and its a lot of its inspiration from the New Deal, from the approach from the US government coming out of the Depression. And, of course, go back almost 100 years and you had a society that had previously been ravaged by a pandemic and then got ravaged by a depression. And the government said, look, in terms of how they were going to get out of it, we've got a lot of people who are looking for work, a lot of people who need support. thought. It was really the opportunity in the US to not only begin building the welfare state and make sure that everyone was looked after as they got out of the Depression, but also developed a lot of things of long-lasting benefit to the country. A lot of transport networks, they built the US National Park system out of it. It really was a process of saying to everyone, look, we're going to look after everyone. If you want a job, we will find you one, and we'll do it on a project that isn't a make-work project, but instead is a project that's going to deliver lasting benefit to the country. And that's the approach that we're taking here. We're saying it's time for some significant investment, time for once-in-a-generation size investment to get out of these crises. And so we contain a number of elements that will do what Richard has said of trying to solve a number of problems at once. So a big part of it is building 500,000 new public housing homes over the next 15 years, which would create about 40,000 construction jobs and 4,000 apprenticeships if you put in a ratio of required apprenticeships on that project, at the same time as helping tackle the public housing and homelessness crisis. We want to revitalise manufacturing by setting up a new body, Manufacturing Australia, modelled a lot on the Clean Energy Finance Corporation, because we think with things like green steel, steel produced through hydrogen, if you had in Australia some strong local procurement laws that said, look, as we're building high-speed rail down the East Coast or wind turbines as part of the offshore wind farms, you use green, locally made steel, you could really, through a body such as Manufacturing Australia, really revitalise the manufacturing sector in this country. And also, of course, getting to 100% renewables and getting that done over the next 10 years. But I think it's important to realise that a low emissions job isn't just putting up solar panels. Teaching's a low emissions job. Aged care's a low emissions job. And so a big part of our plan is also expanding that caring and service and education sector in the economy, getting back to having free education in this country, increasing the size of the aged care workforce, making childcare free as well, and lastly, ensuring that we get the arts and creative sectors back on their feet. I think you've paid a bit of attention to that in previous webinars. They're completely decimated, a very large employer, a lot of people who aren't getting any of the government's assistance packages at the moment that are being left behind. And it's going to have massive, massive effects because it's going to be a while. If you think about social distancing restrictions, say you can't have more than, 10, 50, 100 people in a room, that's the business model of most people in the arts and creative sector, is to get more than 100 people in the room. And so we're going to need a plan to ensure that those areas are rebuilt. And lastly, we want to have some big, significant projects on rehabilitating our environment, in particular recovering from the bushfire crisis that we've seen. So all of that, on our estimation, would create somewhere in the order of 620,000 jobs, funded as part of our plan. And an additional component of it that perhaps we can talk about in a moment will come through our jobs guarantee approach as well. And we estimate you could be looking at about an additional 250,000 jobs for young people as part of that.
So, Richard, 650,000 jobs plus a potential 200,000 more, is that roughly the size of, what the government needs to be doing to keep the economy afloat at this time?
Look, absolutely. I mean, we're still at the very beginning of this economic crisis, but what we've already seen is that kind of number of people either, as Adam said, losing their jobs or losing a lot of hours and not having enough work. So economics is, we define ourselves in economics, we teach our students that economics is concerned with the efficient allocation of scarce resources. Well, there's nothing less efficient than having hundreds of thousands, millions of people sitting around wishing they had a job to do, creating important work, creating productive work, creating work so that those people not only earn an income but make stuff that the rest of us can benefit from, is central to economics. It's central to efficiency and it's central to well-being and cohesiveness in our society. So absolutely, we need to talk about very big numbers when it comes to job creation. And I think it's really important to emphasise what Adam said a minute ago. We have to not fall into the mistake of thinking that a green job is a job installing solar panels. To give people some sense of perspective, there's around 24 million people in Australia. Less than 0.5% of people work in the coal industry. Less than 2% of people work in the entire mining industry. If we transition and spend an enormous amount of money in the coming decades installing solar and wind, we'll probably employ around 2% of the population in that definition of a green job. So put another way, if only 2% of people work in mining and around 2% of people work in installing energy, it means 96% of us don't work in brown jobs or green jobs, 96% of us just work in jobs. And when we're talking about rescuing the macro economy from mass unemployment, there's no one industry that's big enough to soak that up. But also, it's, I think, a misunderstanding. We don't want to have 100% of us employed installing windmills. That would be weird. We don't want to have 50% of people employed installing solar panels. That would be weird. The fewer people we can employ to install enough solar panels and windmills for us all to have all the energy we need, and batteries, of course, the fewer people we employ to do that, the more people we can employ to do other great stuff that we need done as well. So we have to be very careful not to think that a Green New Deal is all about everyone working in so-called green industries. A, we don't want to and need everyone to work in them, and B, aged care, childcare, healthcare, education, these are the massive employers in Australia, and they're very, very green jobs. I mean, if you compare the emissions associated with importing enormous new utes for people to drive around, which we're subsidising at the moment, with employing more teachers and nurses, I think the community gets a lot more impact out of supporting valuable public sector jobs than it does out of subsidising enormous imported vehicles to obscure my view when I'm trying to drive.
So, Adam, you were talking about that jobs guarantee. I just wondered if you could unpack the detail about that for people who perhaps are unfamiliar with the term even.
Yeah, so as part of our recovery plan, because young people in particular are being so hard hit by this crisis, and because, you know, if you start your working life during a time of recession, it can take you a lifetime to recover, not only in terms of lost wages, but for many people, they just end up completely disconnecting from the system altogether. We need a special plan and approach to make sure that all of those crises are tackled, and that young people aren't left with an economy in 10 years' time that is still suffering from the cuts. Because if you look at what the UK did when it tried to come out of the GFC, it just embarked on this austerity drive and said, oh, we've got to cut to pay back the debt. And then what happened? Well, fast forward 10 years later and you find hundreds of thousands of people living in poverty. You find an economy that's in strife, and you find younger people who started their working lives during that GFC in enormous strife. So we're proposing what we're calling a next-gen guarantee, which is a guarantee for young people to say that under our plan, we'll guarantee you your choice of either free education at university or TAFE, so that you could use this opportunity to skill or reskill, a guaranteed job working on one of these nation-building, planet-saving projects that we spoke about, rehabilitating our environment, building the renewable energy systems of the future, making sure that we've got free education, revitalising our arts sector, at a minimum, a guaranteed income that you can actually live on. So a big part of our plan is ensuring that we retain the rate of the current double level of Newstart, everyone over 22, and a slightly lower rate for people who are studying under 22. But every young person would then be guaranteed either an income that they could live on, or a decent job at industry wages, or a place in free education. And the idea of a jobs guarantee is to say, you know, we hear a lot about full employment, and the government trumpets getting to full employment. And most people would think, well, full employment means if someone wants a job, they can get one, a decent job. and not this sort of insecure 1 hour here or a shift there that counts as unemployment in the, as employed in the statistics, but really doesn't give you enough to live on and can actually make your life worse, but a decent job that is well paid and that is secure if you want one. So be making a promise to young people, if you want a job working on one of these projects, we will find you one. A, because we think that the employment creation potential of these will be so huge and so significant, but B, it's a responsibility, I think, of our society to say we are not going to have a lost generation. And like, I get increasingly frustrated by to do this, I should say, involves a fundamental break from neoliberalism, because neoliberalism says, oh, well, 5% unemployment with a whole bunch of hidden underemployment is fine. And if that means you have to have a very insecure life doing bits and pieces of work here and there, well, so be it. That's what the private sector says. This involves a fundamental break. It says government's actually got a responsibility towards its population, including to give people jobs if they want them. And to those who say, oh, well, the jobs guarantee, can you actually do that? So yes, you can. And I'd say, what's the alternative? Because at the moment, the alternative will seem to be, for a lot of young people, is going to be potentially living below the poverty line on low levels of unemployment benefits that the government wants to take them back to. Now, come back to the start. We've got a lot of work that needs to be done to set the country up and to deal with the crises that we've got. We've got a lot of people who will be looking for work. Let's put two and two together. And that's what a jobs guarantee is about.
Richard, I know you've had your own experience of recession and kind of early on in your career. Would a jobs guarantee, what role would that play in the economy? Would it maybe set a floor under kind of wages and conditions, I'm guessing, or what role would that play?
Yeah, absolutely. I graduated from uni just in time to experience the 1991 recession. It was an absolutely terrible time of my life, as it was for a lot of people my age. And yeah, at the time, classic recession, classic macroeconomic problem, far more people looking for jobs than there were jobs available. I had exactly the same skills then that I have now, just to be clear. Like, when we want to talk about skills all the time, skills are important. Of course we should try and impart skills on young people, on middle-aged people, on old people who want them. We absolutely should. This government's been in for 7 years. For 7 years, they've been talking about skills. So if in 7 years they weren't able to create what they think is a good enough system to help people acquire the skills they need, what on earth makes us believe that they'll be able to come up with something in the next 6 or 12 months? The problem that we're about to experience is a problem of mass unemployment. It's not a shortage of, we don't have a sudden shortage of skills. There's been no outbreak of unskilledness. What there's been is an enormous reduction in demand for staff, which means an enormous reduction in the demand for labour. And it makes me really sad, thinking particularly about a whole bunch of young people who've just come out of uni last summer who are going to really struggle to get their first job in the way that I did 30 years ago. It's horrible. So the question is, as a society, how, if at all, do we want to help those young people? Now, of course, we'll give them a meagre youth allowance. So we've already agreed to help them, and we might give them meagre unemployment benefits. The question Adam's raising is, well, what if we did a lot better than that? What if we either promised them more study, if that's what they think they need, or a job to work on something that we all collectively agree is important, a job at good pay with good conditions? Now, that messes with a whole bunch of people's heads. You know, where will the money come from? How can we afford to do that? Well, there's a couple of different answers. The first answer is to understand that in Australia today, we spend tens of billions of dollars a year paying people to not work, right? We hand out billions of dollars in franking credit refunds to people who don't work. We hand out $30 billion a year in tax concessions for superannuation, mainly to high-income earners, to not work. And, of course, we spend a fortune on unemployment benefits. So transitioning the way we package up the spending we currently have, if we're happy to pay old people to not work, why wouldn't we be willing to pay young people to work? Like, it's absurd. So that's sort of the first line of argument. The second line of argument, which Adam alluded to, is also very important, and that is the idea that folk can't afford to because the government has to balance the budget is economically absurd. No economists actually believe that. And Ross Gittins has got a great piece in the Herald today. I encourage everyone to read it. He knows, as I do, as Adam does, as all economists know, there's no problem with governments spending a lot of money. There's no problem with them having deficits. But Ross's line is the Baptist line that the problem isn't dancing. The problem is that dancing leads to sex. You know, so you've got to stop the kids dancing or we know where it will end. Well, economists don't think government spending's bad, but there's this fear that if government starts spending money on problems, that maybe we'll either design a kind of society that some people don't like, or in time we might end up increasing taxes. So we have to pretend that government spending is bad. When government spending's not bad and deficits aren't bad, it's just a whole bunch of people don't like where that might take us. So, yeah, you know, it's so important that we do everything we can to stop it, not just a generation of young people, but middle-aged people, old people, whoever's experiencing involuntary unemployment, let's do everything we can to help them. Let's not pretend we can't afford to, and let's not pretend that deficits are in any way a constraint for us doing that.
So just to let everyone who's on this webinar know, we've got about 1,250 participants today. So thank you everyone for coming along, and I can see we've got about 60 questions in the Q&A. So we're not going to be able to get to all of those, but we'll come to them in just a minute. And again, if you'd like to ask a question of Adam or Richard directly, use the raise your hand function and we'll come to you very shortly. Adam, before we go to questions from the audience, I did just want to kind of come back and touch on, the huge issue of inequality that we had even before the pandemic, and perhaps to get your response to what the Prime Minister announced in his speech at the National Press Club yesterday.
Yeah, I think the Prime Minister is trying to kick the can down the road. I think that it's sort of a phone a friend approach to how to deal with the current economic crisis. There's no government-driven plan itself, and he's talking about getting people together to change the rules around IR. Rewriting the industrial relations rules in the way that Scott Morrison wants is not the way to create jobs. And there's talk about, is this a follow-up to the Accord or Accord 2.0? And like, I've got a lot of criticisms of the Accord, but what it was a government that had a vision about the particular way that it wanted to reform the economy. And it's in the Labor Party's case, it was to introduce neoliberalism to Australia, and it did it. But what it did was not just change the IR rules, it changed the social wage. It had a whole lot of other components to it and involved significant government spending. Scott Morrison's not offering any of that. So there's no vision here. He's kind of outsourcing vision, saying, I hope that others of you will come up with the answer. And the key point has got to be, this is the best time in history for government to invest. Like, money has not been cheaper. And to pick up that point about can we afford it, like on our calculations, the kind of when you look at that, we're spending over this for the tax cuts package, the personal incomes tax cuts package that's been legislated, that's going to cost us $280 billion over the next 10 years. Like, money is there for significant projects. It's a matter of priorities. And on our calculations, our projects, the ongoing cost of the project could be funded by things like winding back unfair tax breaks for fossil fuel polluters and tax cuts for millionaire packages and so on. And that with this borrowing to invest, you would end up with debt in Australia still being less than half of what the advanced economy's average is. So like, it's all eminently affordable. It is all a question of priorities. And I think the government's response so far to say, well, we're just going to get everyone around a table and hope that someone else comes up with the answer, shows a striking lack of vision. And I think it comes back to this point about our plan involves a break from neoliberalism because it involves rethinking questions of debt and deficit and not being fetishized or using or being straitjacketed by them, because otherwise inequalities is going to keep on going up.
Richard, your response to that comment around debt, if you could keep it to under 30 seconds and then we'll go to questions.
Australia is one of the richest countries in the world. We live at the richest point in world history. We have low levels of debt by international comparisons. We have low levels of debt by historic comparisons. Interest rates are at all-time lows, and countries that print their own currency can't go bankrupt. There is absolutely no constraint to us borrowing some more money. What we have to have an important debate about, though, is of all the things we should spend that on, what will set us up for the future we want to have. We shouldn't just say spend money. That's actually silly. We should, and we should never say we can't afford to. That's absurd. What we actually have to have is a democratic conversation about what are the kind of things we need more of and who's going to build them. And there's nothing to stop us doing that, except that some people don't want to. And your cat just walked in the shop.
I know. Can't stop her doing it. So Janet Lawrence, if you're on the line, we're going to come to you in just a second to ask your question directly. But I'll start with one from Paul Loring in WA. He says, for decades, salaried employees have increasing unpaid hours, yet many workers are unemployed or underemployed prior to the pandemic. And he'd like to know where the Greens stand on Jacinda Ardern's idea of a potential four-day work week, and would it fit with the idea of a Green New Deal?
Yeah, so great question, Paul. Thanks. In this country, if you work 1 hour a week, you're counted as employed. And so it's no wonder the government trumpets the unemployment stats and never looks at underemployment, which is a better measure. Or another way of talking about that is that there's really high job insecurity in Australia, and people might be notionally counted as being employed, but it's you can't be guaranteed a wage or hours of work from week to week or even day to day or even hour to hour in some sectors. And it affects your life, and that's why the insecurity that's part and parcel of neoliberalism needs to be stamped out, and that's part of our approach. In terms of hours a week, we also do a very bad job in this country of matching the hours people want to work with the hours people actually work. There's high underemployment, but also certainly pre-corona, there's also a lot of people who are overemployed in the sense that they are required to work more hours than they would like, especially a lot of it is unpaid, and that's especially the case for a lot of women, and it's especially the case if you've got caring responsibility. So I think there definitely is a case for saying over time, should we adjust the working week to make a fairer share of hours. But the one of the things I think we need to be especially aware of, though, as we talk about that, is that although overemployment is a problem, it's actually underemployment that's a huge problem as well. And so for a lot of people, when they hear the phrase four-day working week, if you're full-time or you're getting stretched, like that sounds like a good idea, and for many people it is. But for many people, they'd be saying, oh, geez, I wish I could work 4 days. I wish I could work that many hours because I'm just not getting the wages that I need to. So if it's as part of a plan to say, let's ensure that everyone is able to work as many hours as they want and as they need, then I'm all for it.
Janet Lawrence, I'm trying to unmute you here. I'm not sure if you've accidentally raised your hand. Are you there?
I am here.
What's your question for the panel?
My question is that as we have a government that really doesn't value the environment, say, this very necessary thing that we need to do at the moment, the rehabilitation for the planet, but our contribution in Australia has to be enormous, how do we inspire them to have that value to do it, to see the environment in other terms than purely an economic kind of plunder?
Yeah, great question, particularly I think after the horrid bushfire season that we had here, just a few months ago. First to you, Adam. Thanks, Janet.
Yeah, thanks, Janet. Really good question. And a huge part of our recovery plan is a significant investment in a habitat restoration fund to clean up our rivers and I think and to rehabilitate after the bushfires. In terms of how you get the government to come on board with it. One of the things that I've been talking about, that we're talking about as this plan is, as someone who's in Melbourne, is wouldn't it be great to be able to swim in the Yarra again? And there used to be something that we were able to do, but and now you can't because it's polluted and there hasn't been enough attention paid to it. And I think we'd say the same in South Australia with the Torrens, less so in some of the other cities. But if we had a project of saying let's put people to work if they want to on getting our rivers swimmable again and getting our water clean, then I think that's the kind of thing that starts to resonate across sections no matter who you vote for. And I guess secondly, I would say there's an Eden Monaro by-election coming up soon, and the one of the things that's becoming crystal clear is that the government hasn't done anywhere near enough in terms of rehabilitating our environment after the fires. And I think in those political opportunities, we'll be trying to make the point that part of our pathway to recovery is not only tackling the climate crisis, but restoring our land and our environment after it's been damaged.
Richard, did you want to add anything to that?
Oh, look, I mean, the literal answer to your question, how do you get the government to care more? Well, maybe they just don't care, in which case you need to vote and perhaps other people need to vote for different parliamentarians. But ultimately, you know, we live in a democracy, imperfect though that is. I wish this government didn't see this bizarre trade-off between the environment and the economy. As an economist, that makes no sense at all. But let's unpack their political strategy. What they're trying to do is say to particular groups in Australia, vote for me, I'm going to help you with your problem. So we love to tell people in regional Australia that the only reason they haven't got a job is because some environmentalists stopped a mine going ahead, or some environmentalists stopped a dam going ahead, or some environmentalists stopped some logging. You know, it's a pretty straightforward political strategy, even though I'm sure Adam would say it's frustrating that the Greens haven't been able to at times stop more of these things from happening. The group that's been in power for 7 years blames a group who's not in power for the mass unemployment of people in National Party seats. So the politics of what's playing out is pretty brutal. Those that are pushing to improve our environmental outcomes are quite deliberately being played off against vulnerable people with low incomes in regions experiencing high unemployment. We need to build a bridge between that. But that the fact that these groups don't seem to be able to talk well together is no accident. It's an explicit political strategy.
Thanks, Richard. Alithea Bone, if you're there, I can see you've got kind of a related question that I thought was a good one. What's that question? Can't hear Alithea, so I'll just read out her question. She says, Adam, given the stark political divide on climate change and the tendency for a green approach to be associated with inner city elites, how do we get suburban, rural and regional Australians on board with the concept of a Green New Deal?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, I'd say two things. One is, I think increasingly, especially after the summer that we've just had, people increasingly are now feeling the climate crisis really viscerally. Like, it's no longer just something that might happen in the future. It's something that's happening now, and it's something that's happening to a lot of people. It's happening in the inner city when you can't take your kid to childcare, as I couldn't one time over summer because the smoke levels were too high. But it's happening in the regional areas where people are losing their homes and their lives and now living under enormous threat and are saying, look, it never used to be like this. I think one of the things that I found in my time as a Greens MP, both locally here in Melbourne, where we've sort of grown the vote beyond people who might usually expect to vote Green, but also on the national stage, is that the people understand that the climate crisis is real. People like the Greens' plan to ultimately say we've got to get out of coal and replace it with renewables. Well, one of the things that they want to know is what's the plan about jobs? What's the plan for having a strong economy? What's the plan for ensuring that we can all lead a good life? And it comes back to some of that stuff that Richard was saying about they might have heard a lot from our opponents, but they haven't necessarily heard from us. And so part of the invest to recover approach, part of the Green New Deal approach, is to say that in this approach, the economy and jobs and your security is important too. And it's about decent work that allows you and your loved ones to live a good life and not feel constantly insecure or feel like you might lose your job at any moment, but in doing so in a way that looks after the planet and doesn't restore it, doesn't destroy it. So I think part of the answer is to be clearer about talking about the things that matter to a lot of people, but also I think the second part is to acknowledge that actually people are feeling the climate crisis a lot more now and are probably more open to solutions on it than they have been for a long time.
Richard, did you want to add anything to that?
Look, no, I agree. I just think that we need to, as I said at the outset, we need to not sort of petition all these problems and either pretend that different people are responsible for solving them or that we have to argue about which one to solve first. The climate crisis is already imposing enormous costs on some regions. Mass unemployment in Australia is already imposing enormous costs, in particularly in some regions. We need to take a big picture approach to that. But in doing that, if we were to do that, we just have to admit that that would be quite a significant shift to the way we think about the economy in Australia and the groups that usually benefit from government policy. It's no accident that the minute there's a crisis like this, the same old suspects run out and say, now's a great time to give me that tax cut I've been after for 20 years, or now's a great time to give me that industrial relations reform I've been after for 20 years, or now's a great time to pour billions of dollars worth of concrete in that place I've wanted to pour it for years. We've got hundreds of thousands of people that have just lost their jobs in retail, that have just lost their jobs in hospitality. They're not going to get a job pouring concrete for years. So it's a cruel hoax for people to run around saying, I've got a stimulus package or a reform package in infrastructure or industrial relations that's going to help those groups. It's a cruel hoax. And until we admit how big the problem is, and how multifaceted the problem is, all these partial solutions getting thrown around by the usual suspects are literally just a cruel hoax.
Thanks, Richard. Emma Winnell, can you hear me there? You've got a
yeah,
big question about universities. What's your question?
Thanks very much, Richard and Adam, for your discussion so far. I was just wondering specifically in relation to universities. Obviously, we're taking a really hard hit at the moment. And the people who seem to be paying for it the most are casual workers. And in fact, I've been working as a casual at university for almost a decade now. And I'm looking to lose my job in the second semester. So I'm just wondering your thoughts on the corporatization of the university sector, as well as the casualization of the workforce, which has led to over 70% of workers in this area being casual.
Yeah, it's a huge problem and something we've been trying to address in raising Parliament and tackling Parliament for some time. I've introduced a bill a few years back to wind back the insecure and casual work, including in the university sector. And I remember someone coming in, giving evidence to one of our inquiries, saying, much like you just did, that she worked in the same department of the same university for 10 years and wasn't entitled to a day of sick leave during that time because she was treated as casual and on rolling casual contracts, as if there's such a thing in law, for all of that time. And that just makes it impossible to plan your life, to have some, to put roots down, to have some basic security. And that we've gone to every election and continued to push for changes to the way that universities are funded to not only increase the funding, because I think we're seeing now how much of a cost shifting there's been away from the government towards international students, and when that money is no longer available, then universities, it turns out, are not properly funded in this country and need to be properly funded. But that funding needs to come with strings to ensure that there's some security in the work that's available to people. And there also needs to be, I think, a broader change in the law in this country to say that, yeah, there's a place for casual work. Of course there is. It works for many people. But it needs to be restricted to only real casual jobs, and that the presumption in law should be that every job is ongoing unless you can come up with a demonstrable reason otherwise, because Australia ranks very badly internationally when it comes to exploiting the use of casual and insecure work. And I think that's, like, people have this idea that at universities everyone's living these wonderfully tenured lives, but less than 30% of the people who, or less than a third of the people who work at universities have that ongoing tenured work in the way that it's commonly understood. So universities, I think, have been, and like a lot of the economy, but especially acute in universities, have been really attacked by insecure employment. And for us, restoring the funding to universities and changing the rules according to which the IR system in universities operates is a big part of not only our recovery plan but our approach more generally.
Ebony, I should give a plug here. I've just written a piece on neoliberalism in the university for this Saturday paper. So hopefully they accept it and run it. thanks for your question. It's really important. And actually, quit my first academic job 25 years ago, and I had tenure. And I remember one of my professors saying, "But Richard, you're giving up tenure." I said, "I know, but you hate your life." kind of shrugged his shoulders, and I'm happy with my choices. But for those that are in university, it's appalling the degree of casualisation the system now relies on. It didn't used to. It obviously didn't used to. And the point that I make in this piece, which hopefully they run, no pressure Saturday paper, is that universities don't just teach neoliberalism. Universities embody neoliberalism more than any other publicly owned institution in Australia. Our universities embody the values of neoliberalism. They rely explicitly on competition between universities and competition between staff. They rely more heavily on casualisation than any other public sector enterprise. And, of course, they've commodified their product far more than any other public good. And by that I mean, you know, nurses provide valuable services that everyone thinks are inherently valuable. You don't really hear nurses talking about the future income of the patient they help. Whereas in universities now, we're so insecure, we have to justify higher education by saying, you know, we're going to give you this little commodity called a degree, and that's okay, and that's important because you'll get a pay rise because we gave you that education. So I think our universities are far more neoliberal than people realise in their culture and their values. And importantly, and of course the government should do more. It's outrageous that they're providing JobKeeper to private universities and not public universities. But I would encourage any academic, this is not hard, I'd encourage any academic to Google the annual report of your university, go to the back, read the financial section, and look at the billions of dollars that have been accumulated by your institution that are sitting there literally in a pile of cash and shares, which at the moment they're saying they have no choice but to cut pay. They have no choice but to sack casuals. When they say they have no choice, what they meant to say was, because I don't want to run down these enormous reserves that I built up by overcharging students for decades, I'm going to sit on my pile of gold and I'm going to sack some casuals. It is obscene to say they have no choice. They've got billions of dollars worth of choices. According to the government, own analysis, the unis are sitting on $20 billion in financial assets at the moment. Imagine if Centrelink was stockpiling welfare to help future unemployed people. Our universities are sitting on $20 billion worth of assets that they could spend on helping their casuals if they wanted to.
And just very quickly, Ebony, just when Parliament goes back, we'll be pushing to extend JobKeeper to universities as well.
Yeah, that $60 billion that we suddenly forgot to spend or didn't spend does seem like a good thing to spend it on. We've got another question here from Rebecca Sweeney, who asks, how do we put a halt to the pervasive abuse of power when it's not Parliament that the fossil fuel lobbyists inhabit? So I'm not quite sure how that's worded there, but... perhaps a comment on the power of the fossil fuel lobby.
Yeah, it's an important point, and there's a revolving door at the moment between MPs and ministers and fossil fuel companies. So, yes, it's the lobbyists who come and patrol the corridors of Canberra and having seen it in action, it is a scary sight to behold, them coming in and basically saying to an MP, oh yeah, you can vote this way if you want, but I'm going to run a campaign against you and unseat you at the next election if you do. And they tend to get their way on pokies, on mining, or fossil fuels in particular. But also when a lot of MPs are there just warming their seat and they go out and they take a job as an executive or the head of one of the lobbying associations within one of the fossil fuel companies. And it works the other way around as well, with high levels of staffing, for example, in the Prime Minister's office coming out of the fossil fuel sector. So there's a very, very tight interconnection between the two. And I think one of the things that we've got to do is get the big money out of politics, like restrict donations to $1,000, no matter who you are, where you come from, how big your checkbook is, restrict donations to $1,000. And also, if we started restricting the amount that could be spent during election campaigns by political parties, then you remove the incentive to fundraise so much in the first place. And so I think some tightening of the rules when it comes to money in Australia, and also I think secondly, like the willingness of politicians needing to have a bit of guts and say, look, we're going to act in the public interest, because actually in many instances the public interest is not the same as the interests of the coal and gas companies. And so I think there's a lot of votes to be won from politicians who are prepared to stand up and show that level of courage.
I agree with that, but I would add, we obviously need a federal corruption watchdog and integrity committee. Let me get back a step. Cynicism is your enemy. I know it feels good saying, the lobbyists do this and the big money does that, and I agree. I absolutely agree. Our parliamentary outcomes do not reflect the public will on important issues because of the power of some lobbyists. But I think we can either sort of shrug our shoulders and feel cynical about that, or we can be enraged by that and act. And I would encourage people to not think, we can't ever win because the lobbyists will outspend us. That's not how we got a carbon price in. Don't forget, we got one in. It was ripped up again, but we got one in. That's not how same-sex marriage was fixed. It's not how we ended up having a royal commission into institutionalized sexual abuse. All of those things were fought tooth and nail by some of the most powerful lobbyists in the country, and they lost. So I am not naive, and I am not Pollyanna-ish about how democracy works, but it does not help when we believe we, quote, can't win because the lobbyists. We have to win because the lobbyists. And Adam's right, donation reforms will help. And corruption watchdog will help, but ultimately angry voters with high expectations will help far more than any institutional change. The worst thing we can fall into is thinking that there's nothing we can do about the lobbyists. Adam's right. Politicians fear lobbyists running a campaign against them. They fear voting against them even more. And we have to be careful not to kind of collapse into a clever version of cynicism. I'm not accusing the questioner of that. I'm saying a lot of people think, it's the lobbyists and we can't win. That's crap. We can win. We have win. People win in other countries. We need some motivated democratic action, and we need some structural change. But let's never believe we can't win. That's what they want us to think.
And we are winning on the ICAC at the moment too. Yeah. Like, that is something that, like, I introduced the first bill into the House of Reps for an ICAC, and at the time we had a couple of voices on our side. We've now, over time, got the Labor Party supporting a Federal Integrity Commission and some backbenchers, and a bill has actually passed the Senate to introduce a federal ICAC, a federal ICAC with teeth. So it's actually managed to get enough cross-party support to pass the Senate, and it's waiting for debate and vote in the House. The government doesn't want to do that. In fact, the government has just said they're going to use the corona crisis as the latest excuse to not introduce it. And when Parliament goes back, we're going to be pushing to bring that bill on for a vote. So I think what Richard said is dead right. Like, people power has worked, got the carbon price, it got significant amount of reform, and I think it's going to get us a federal ICAC as well, because even people on the coalition understand that the will is there and it's now unstoppable.
George Davidson, I'm wondering if you're there on the line.
Yes, I'm here. Yeah, so my question was for Adam. And speaking about the Yarra River, there was legislation passed in Victoria there not too long ago about giving it an identity, but it doesn't really go far enough in my view. I'm wondering, do you think law reform to give the Yarra legal rights is a good idea?
Yeah, I know that that's a good question, George. I think, and I know that's been looked at in other countries, legislating to give nature rights. And I certainly think there is a case, whether it's formally giving a river legal rights or whether it's just increasing the role of nature and the standing of nature under our environmental laws, there definitely is a case for lifting that to give greater protection. I mean, people, like our environment laws at the moment actually don't give anywhere near enough protection to nature as such, and it isn't accorded any kind of particular status as opposed to particular species, for example, that might be threatened. Nature as such doesn't have any standing in our environmental laws at the moment, and I think ultimately that needs to change. I guess part of the point that I'm making, it comes back to that earlier question about how do we build a broad base of support to get changes like this through and legislation like this through. And one of the things that I think is important for us is to also, as we try and reach out to new audiences, is to also say to people, look, this isn't just about saving the planet. This is actually about a better life for you and your family as well. And the two aren't counterposed to each other. And it's not about giving nature rights that then you might not have. This is about saying, we'll create a better world where you'd be able to go and jump in the river and have a swim because that's how clean it is. And I think that if we can start to convince more and more people that these changes are going to solve multiple problems and are going to make their lives better as well, then I think we're going to get broader acceptance.
Thanks, Adam. I've got one last question here, and if you could both, Richard and Adam, keep your answers to about a minute, I think that'll bring us in on time. The last question is from Joshua Sibbing. He asks, now that working from home is becoming so normalised, how can we ensure that the lines between work and leisure time don't blur further and that workers don't become constant working machines with even less rights than before? First to you, Adam.
Look, I think one of the things that's clear from all of this is that we can't go back to the way it was before. We need to work out what it means to build a new normal. But key to making all of, and the other lesson from the corona crisis is that the things that are getting us through it are all the things that neoliberalism has attacked, like strong public institutions and strong public healthcare and putting human life ahead of a budget surplus. So to get things like better protections for workers as we return to work and greater control, what we're actually going to need is to give workers and the public more say in the decisions that are made, more say in the decisions of their workplace, more say in the decisions of government, so that when decisions are made by government, they're made in the public interest, not for vested interest, and when they're made in the workplace, they're made with wellbeing in mind. And so I think part of that is people joining their unions, but part of it is also changing the laws so that people have more control over their lives so that we don't just snap back to whatever normal was before.
And Richard, under 30 seconds if you can.
I agree with all that. Check out the work from our Australia Institute's colleagues at the Centre for Future Work on how to balance work from home. And look, for more than a decade, the Institute has run National Go Home on Time Day. We'll be running it again this year. And your question has made me realise, how on earth do you go home on time when you're working from home? So we're going to have to rethink that one as well.
Well, we're going to have to wrap it up there. So thank you very much for your time today, Adam. Thanks for coming along.
Pleasure. Thank you.
And thanks, Richard. So thank you to both our panellists and to everyone who's joined us today. We really appreciate you coming along.
This has been a special episode of Follow the Money, and we're aiming to bring you shorter but more frequent episodes during the pandemic, so stay tuned. You can check out the Australia Institute's Economics of a Pandemic webinar series at our website, tai.org.au/webinars. And the next event is on Thursday, the 4th of June at 1 p.m. with ACTU Secretary Sally McManus in conversation with Jim Stanford, Director and Economist at the Australia Institute's Centre for Future Work. For the latest health information, you can check health.gov.au or listen to the ABC's excellent CoronaCast podcast, which comes out daily. You can visit tai.org.au for all our latest research and content, and we're on Twitter at the Oz Institute with an AUS. My Twitter handle is Ebony_Bennett with a double N double T. Adam Bandt is at Adam Bandt, that's B-A-N-D-T. And Richard Dennis is at RDNS_TAI. This episode was produced by Jennifer Macy, and our theme music is by Jonathan McFeet from Pulse and Thrum. And remember, stay 1.5 metres away, keep washing those hands, and thanks for listening.